I just learned that as of March 2019, the world record for the loudest scream is 129 decibels.
They have to be going high on that, right? Like a squeal.
I don't know. It doesn't say.
Okay,
But
wait. How does pitch work? It like okay, so if you're a higher pitch, was that does that mean it's like a smaller band of frequency?
I don't know. I'm looking it up.
For some reason, I don't know. For some reason, I'm thinking lower is
Found
like a
it.
larger.
Wait, maybe I didn't find it.
Hold on, I'm gonna search pitch visualized.
Pitch is a subjective dimension of hearing. It is the sound
Oh.
quality most cl closely related to the frequency of a pure tone. High frequency tones are perceived as being of high pitch, while low frequency tones are said to be of low pitch.
Okay. That's
So.
what, okay, so that's what I was wondering, because it's like a higher pitch is a higher frequency. So it's just like an output with more leverage,
Yeah.
basically. Like you're getting more volume for the amount of energy that you're pushing out, versus if you just like trying to yell as low pitch as you can, as loud as you can, you'll just be like, oh, like you'll just be like, it won't be anything. But yeah,
Well,
I thought about that.
that's what's weird. Well, I guess this leads into something else that we're gonna talk about, but there's, I don't know, there's some interesting facts I just found about sound and low frequencies being used for, like, as a tool, almost. Which is interesting because I thought that higher frequencies would be more powerful, kind of like what you're saying. But
Yeah.
it turns out, what does it say? That, like, there's a recent study suggesting that the pyramids in Giza were like, they, what does it say? They claim that ancient Egyptians benefited from the sound in the construction of the Great Pyramid of Giza. So the sound inside of it. They relied on the discovery of a dead end in the rock inside the pyramid room as a tube of acoustic resonance that generates ultrasonic waves at a base frequency within 5 hertz. 5 hertz is like, you can barely even hear that. You can't hear that, actually. I think the human ear can only hear, human hearing range starts as low as 20 hertz.
20 hertz,
So
okay.
it's suggesting that this low frequency was used to actually move rocks into place, like big ass rocks to build the pyramids. And I've heard there's been a lot of religious books that, like, my mom has given me and stuff, or that I've heard of from her that suggest that same thing, like religious figures building things like Noah's Ark or whatever, like with sound and less, I don't know, labor. And it kind of makes sense because you look at those structures. And you look at these buildings that were built, you know, thousands of years ago, and they're fucking huge, and they don't have cranes or like anything, or maybe they did, I don't know, but something like it. But like, yeah, that's something I've looked at a lot in the past. Is yeah, just you people using sound to change. I don't
This is just like, what is it like the wind? Like they have like an entry point where the wind is normally blowing and the wind like blows in and then goes through these chambers and then hits this certain size.
I'm not really sure. That's what I was trying to look at. This raises the question of the importance of ultrasound for the ancients, and can we find the use of sound waves between ancient cultures, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, it doesn't really say, like, where the sound would be coming from. That's probably a good part of the puzzle to have. Maybe it's just, like, a hum or something. Like, because that's the thing. 5 hertz, like, I'm trying to think, like, what a bass would be at. Like, tuned to A. That'd probably be close to, like, 5 hertz. Like, just playing an open A note on a bass, like, tuned down to A.
To drop A, yeah.
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 Like.
And you know what that's, it's just, like, deep fart.
So. Yeah. Yeah. Or, like, if you've ever played, like, on a piano with octaves and stuff, and you go all the way down, and you can't even hear it anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, like, even if it's not about, like, some secret sound technology that we don't know about where, yeah, they could move stuff by vibrating. Like, it might just be for religious purposes. They're, like, meditative. Mm,
I just found they had sound healing.
Sound healing, yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, maybe they just had a way to... I mean, they were geniuses, like the Egyptians. Oddly, this topic also connects with aliens, but I guess everything does.
Yeah, it all goes back to aliens. Well, I mean, the ancient alien and like ancient astronauts, I guess they call them. That's like a big rabbit hole that a lot of people are into.
Yeah.
And I find it quite interesting. And some of the stuff is compelling, I mean, with especially where it crosses over with religion, but yeah, I don't know. Do you know the meme of like it's like any I don't know, culture does something that white people don't do, and then white people aliens.
Yeah, pretty much.
Like, I love that meme. So it's like, I don't want to be that guy.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
The pyramids are like crazy. They're like alien structures.
Yeah.
I mean, especially for their time. There's nothing like it. And we still can't replicate it.
Yeah.
Basically, like, we couldn't make it ourselves.
Except for Bass Pro, but go ahead. Again, I think this is the second time we've brought up the Bass Pro pyramid.
That needs to be our icon or insignia.
Yeah, no, I'm about to bring up the image right now, and just in case anyone wasn't aware. Yeah, there you go. And its beauty. Had to share it on the screen. But yeah, I mean, and them just matching up with constellations and planets and like knowing how they're gonna align and all that shit. Like,
yeah, what I'm looking at right now is actually I'm trying to look for what those gravitational lines are called around the Earth, because we have like gravitational waves, but on the surface of the Earth, it like translates to there being like these streaks where there's like highly dense magnetic activity. Mm-hmm. And I know that the Great Pyramid of Giza is at the intersection of one of these. And there's some other ancient sites that are as well. I think these are called ley lines, L-E-Y line.
Okay.
This is still debated, though, that if ley lines even exist, that's what this is. I'm probably looking at some bullshit right now. But either way, there is like areas with disproportionately high magnetic activity, and the Great Pyramids are one of these, you know? So there's, yeah. And like the sound chamber, there's lots of reasons that, like when we look back on history that makes us think that the ancients, they knew about the forces of nature, and they had intuitions into the forces of nature in ways that maybe we don't, or in ways that we do, but they derived it from a different method, like less technological, maybe more natural.
Yeah, because the digital world didn't exist. So, like, there was more incentive to explore the real world and reality and, like, find how things work and how they don't work and what's good and what's not good. And, like, there was more trial and error in the real world, which I think is the only way to, you know, succeed or accomplish goals. And, like, that's apparent more, like, today more than ever, I think. Unfortunately.
Yeah.
But I mean, not to say that there isn't good that can come from the digital world, you know, like people having that same incentive for digital world stuff, but and building like modern day pyramids in a digital sense, you know. But I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you know, the modern day pyramid is the internet was supposed to be not a pyramid. It was supposed to be flat.
Yeah.
I mean, like, equal. And instead, now, yeah, it's a pyramid scheme.
Yeah. Yeah.
Along with our money system. It's a
pyramid, yeah.
Pyramid scheme. But, yeah. I mean, it's interesting. When I think about, like, the sound resonance stuff, also, like, if you really could shake the ground enough in a certain area, see, like, maybe if you built, like, literally a pyramid of Giza sized pyramid, and you had a chamber in the middle that was just meant to collect all this resonance and vibrate. That's the only experiment that makes sense to me. But if you do that, you imagine putting a big, heavy block in the middle of that room with a resonation. And it would just be like, kind of shaking, and you would just be able to push it.
Yeah. That makes more sense than like thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of people pulling giant...
For hundreds of miles, thousands of miles.
Yeah, just slabs of fucking like the same dimension of rock, like... up or like, you know, like however they built it, like using sound makes way more sense than the hit movie Prince of Egypt. DreamWorks.
Yeah, I love that.
That soundtrack is off the chain.
that part when Moses does DMT.
Yeah. I like the part when the sorcerers in the Egyptian palace are like turning their like staves into snakes and shit.
See, that's another talking about like how they had knowledge into like natural, I don't know, the natural world or the natural forces of.
Well, yeah, people talk about witchcraft and stuff, and like that seemed like witchcraft to me. Like,
well, like the Bible recognizes, and like Christian, like. At least Christians who take the Bible as literal truth, like take the Bible as whole truth, which there's some Christians that are like, oh, the Old Testament, we interpret this way and the New this way. So there's different camps, but like for someone that takes the Old Testament truth, like you believe in magicians, like because along with a lot of other crazy things, but you know, there was claims in the Bible or talk of magicians who could do things like, yeah, turning staves into snakes. What else did they do?
They were just generally had like hidden knowledge and stuff. That's basically kind of what it talks. I mean, even like Solomon, even David, like David, either visited or consulted with a witch or something like that, or like a magician or whatever. Like, yeah, it's really interesting that a lot of religious texts also point to there being things like magicians or whatever.
Yeah, magicians, magic, spirits, and when you look at history, like if we lived 300 years ago, or what was it, three? So in the 1700s, that's like around when Newton was around.
Yeah.
Okay, Newton developed a mathematics that I don't even fully understand. So like Newton was patently smarter than me, but he also spent a majority, not majority, just a huge portion of his time on alchemy.
Right.
And like had a lot of other ideas that we consider kooky nowadays.
Yeah.
But in his, if you lived in his time, if you looked at history, if you looked at texts, the most timeless texts and wisdom that existed, like it was common knowledge that was something was real, and that
that what was real?
Magic.
Magic. Okay.
And of course that God was real. I'm pretty sure Newton was religious or Catholic or something, but. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was just normal to have these mix of like scientific, very scientific and quantitative things like calculus, where you can predict where a certain star is going to be on a certain night based off of the function. You know, like that's one side, but it would be mixed with stuff that's more mysterious and inquisitive and open-ended, like alchemy that he spent so much of his time doing. Mm-hmm. But I don't know, he kind of, or they thought that alchemy was a science somewhat at the time too. But there's just this blurring of science and spirituality in a certain way that we don't, well, we do have that today. It's just not in the mainstream.
Yeah.
Really. Like, there's or a huge.
If it is, if it is in the mainstream, it just has to do with like crystals and shit.
No, dude. Do you know about like the manifestation?
Yeah. Oh,
ideas
yeah.
that people have with quantum, in the quantum field.
No. Well, maybe.
It's just a layer. It seems like to me, which once again, or I know I said this to you before off camera, but I consider myself someone who's like truly open to consideration for all possibilities of reality. No matter which version of reality you take, even the strict scientific, what we know, there's still such huge mysteries even in that reality that you have to take it as it is that we live in an extremely strange universe, and there's mysteries that we just unknowns of unknowns that we don't even know how to inquire what it could be. And so, like, that's how I think. So I don't want to say that the idea of manifestation or whatever is fully bullshit, but there's a huge sect of podcasts and media and influencers that push this stuff, and they're now using like quantum as like the modern lingo and like quantum physics. And these guys are coming out as quantum physicists, you know, through academia. And yeah, maybe they have the degree, but then they're also like spiritual practitioners. Yeah. And they make metaphysical claims that like, yes, you know, like energy is the most bottom state. This is the argument, is that energy is the most bottom state of being, and that matter comes from energy. And then quantum physics proves that. Mm-hmm. And then because of that, we can inwardly resonate with such energies at which we create reality out of our energy and intentions. Okay. And like, that's basically the spiel, which it's a fascinating idea. You know, it's a fun type of idea to think about, but.
So what's the difference?
People aren't doing that.
Yeah. What's the difference between like manifesting, you know, your reality? I've learned a lot about with, you name it. I mean, Wiccan, whatever you want to call it.
Paganism.
Magic, like with a K, like they have always taught that, yeah, you manifest whatever it is you want. You set your intent and you like focus on it, and whatever it is, if your intentions are as you say they are and you focus on it and you do your own little ritual that you come up with to like ensure that that's your intention, that it'll like come true. So what's the difference between that and I guess you were saying they're adding just quantum physics to that concept? Is that am I understanding it correctly?
Yeah, they're basically, yeah, justifying that by saying that now with modern science, we know, like they would admit themselves, like, we can't replicate this in experiment or blah, blah, blah. But we know because we can now peer into the quantum field. Oh. We know that matter comes from energy. And therefore, this explains all this phenomenon that happens and the placebo effect, stuff like that. Which those things are fascinating. Like, the placebo effect is a real, not real thing. Mm-hmm. Like, people can really, I don't want to say can, people have really healed themselves. Mm-hmm. Seemingly, yep. through intention.
Yep.
Or through the placebo. Like, the placebo effect basically is the intention or the belief or the faith of something coming to being or betterment.
Yep.
And the thing that, here I am, and I was like gonna try and tear this idea apart, but really I'm attracted to it in a certain way, because the thing is, there's a line, an invisible line that we don't know where it is, seemingly where we have influence with our intention or with our thinking or with our energy, and then we stop having it. Like, you can have so much influence over your body to where maybe, like, there are meditators, monks, who can regulate their heartbeat at a near superhuman level.
Yeah.
So that's an amount of intention. So, okay, the line's not there, so it's a little further.
Yeah.
But the thing is, we don't know where the line is.
Yeah, we don't know where it ends.
Yeah. And there's and then the placebo effect is, people can get over being sick because they thought they took a drug. Or people can get over being sick because they didn't think they took a good drug or something, but they yep. think their way into it, and it just works.
Yeah.
That's exactly
how I get over colds, is I drink a shit ton of water and I lay in my bed and I'm like, all right, tomorrow I'm not going to be sick. I do that until I get better.
I've thought about this before as well, that like, I have this mentality that I'm not very clean, and I've like exposed myself to a lot of dirty things, and just mm-hmm. that I just have this idea that I have a strong immune system. And yep. then like, when I get sick, I'm thinking about how, like, I'm going to get over this so fast. Like, I have such a strong immune system. And I don't know, like, I just have this kind of,
I've thought about
that in the same way. Like, am I just, like, manifesting this?
Yeah, is there something to that? Or, like, yeah. I mean, I don't know. I have a lot of books on manifesting reality or whatever you want to call it. I've spent a lot of time reading a lot of crazy fucking people talk about it, I guess. But I'm just drawn to more of like the esoteric weirdos for some reason. They're more interesting. But the more I just keep reading it, the more I'm just like, y'all are just living life, it seems like. Like, when you really boil it down, there doesn't have to be this like religious background to it, you know. Like, it just seems like it, I don't know, it seems too, it's not wishy-washy, but it's kind of that to me, the whole concept of like manifesting your whatever you want to call it, what's the word,
your future.
Yeah, like, it's very, very like, I think people do that already, is basically what I'm saying. I think that's such a normal thing that people probably do subconsciously. Maybe not. I mean,
well, it's like, there's an aspect of it that seems to fit into neuroscience, that it has to happen. Like, if you're going to do something, especially if you're going to do something something you haven't done before or something difficult, you need to like think about it.
Yeah.
Like, you need to have it in your head and plan. Okay, but that's a different type of thinking. Planning isn't manifesting necessarily.
Yeah.
But where's that line drawn? And like, so, you know, there's some extent that's like practical and pragmatic. We do need to like manifest and get ready and get our body ready and our mind ready and kind of used to an idea of doing something.
Mm-hmm.
we're going to do something hard in a marathon. But like, where does that, how much of that can you step into? You know, and that's a question. And like, is the culmination of everything you have? Mm-hmm. Is a lot of that credited to, you know, our beliefs or us manifesting or us believing these certain stories, you know, like just as guys, I don't know, we have this belief about what a guy should be able to do, you know, run around and hurt and skate and, you know, kind of do all these rough and things, put ourselves in harm's way. And like, that's just kind of just natural to us. And we can just lean into that and then end up doing crazy stunts and kind of just make things happen. Mm-hmm. Because we have that identity, lean into that, I've been fully harbored, you know.
Yeah.
But it's like, can I do that with anything? And like, what is the extent? Of course, it's not all thinking. You have to live it out, but what? So I don't know. It gets fuzzy, but
yeah,
like you're saying, there's a lot of people that push these ideas and try and be gurus and make YouTube channels and try and make money off of it. And that's sickening, but it's just a plain fact to say that you should have a positive bias. Ugh, I should reframe this, that you should set intentions with positivity. Like, you should have a positive image of yourself, a positive image of what's going to happen. Generally, just like an optimism, because that just that changes your physiology. We know that.
Yeah.
It changes the way you react to things. It changes your capabilities. And so, do you remember when we talked about, oh my gosh, what is it? It's a philosophical argument. Pascal's wager? Yeah, Pascal's wager. This idea that like you should believe in God either way.
Yeah.
Because like, yeah, even if he's not real, it's a good, but you know, if he is, you'll go to hell. If you don't, you should. So Pascal's wager, almost a Pascal's wager type of thing for manifesting or for this idea for positive thinking.
Yeah.
Where it's like, well, we don't really know if it's real or why or what the placebo effect is, but it almost makes sense to do it either way.
Yeah, like what do you have to lose type of thing.
Yeah.
Well, it seems like the more I read it, the more I realized it was basically saying to have a good attitude, kind of like what you're saying too.
Yeah.
Like just like, and that like also with the whole PMA thing, positive mental attitude, you know, like.
Yeah.
All that stuff really does help. Laughing when nothing is funny, like just randomly by yourself in a room, that can boost your mood. Like,
or laughing when something's negative.
Yeah.
You know, like someone who builds up that habit to laugh when something's negative.
That's what I've been trying to do a lot. It gets you in trouble sometimes or in awkward situations, but at the end of the day, it makes you mentally okay with where you're at in life.
Yeah.
No matter what. Cause I mean, I actually talked to Tyler about that recently, that laughter is, it really is the best medicine. And it sucks that a lot of people nowadays are like becoming too serious, I think, which I don't want to damper on any like tragedy, you know. Like, I want people to grieve however they want to grieve, and, like, that's their right, and they should do that, and they should, but I feel like they should be grieving, but also, like, an equal amount of joking just about the absurdity of how fucked up things can be, you know? Because it really helps, at least it's really helped me in my life, like, almost cope or come to terms with things that have happened in my life that I'm just like, how could this happen? And instead of being like, how could this happen? Like, I don't understand it. You kind of just accept you're never going to understand it and laugh at the fact that you're never going to understand it.
Yeah.
And for some reason, it just helps certain people. I don't know. Some people, it doesn't help, you know, but
mm-hmm. I think it's the attitude.
Yeah.
Because I think people, a lot of, maybe this is just a dumbass thing to say, but like, it seems like a lot of people out of pride and like superiority, like more scoffing.
Yeah.
But like the laughter that you want to have is like something like you, I don't know, you stub your toe or something inconvenient happens. You bump into something with your car.
Yeah.
And like, that's something that you could just like, you could let yourself just sit on that for hours and just, fuck, yeah. I wouldn't have done that. Or you can just, I don't know, you can just like take a step back. Yeah, it's just like an attitude of taking a step back and like laughing at, you know, just like inconvenient things happen. Here's another thing, like I have to deal with this.
Well, yeah,
just, I don't know what it is. Because
then whenever multiple people are laughing at something in that moment, then what, are you going to be the asshole that's like, fuck, like sitting there getting upset while everyone's laughing and like it's not really that big of a deal?
So, yeah, there's almost like a social, or when you fall down, like when you stub your toe or trip, like when you're alone and you trip, you just like gasp and heavy breathe and just like look around.
And yeah,
and then you see if anyone saw. But yeah. Like when you're with your friends, like you'll all laugh. Yeah. So there's like a social pressure. But can you do it without the social pressure? Can you do it just as yourself, kind of separating from yourself, laughing at yourself?
That's true freedom. I think that's true. I think that's true. Like that's some big brain shit. Like that's some stuff you have to do exactly what you were saying. Like take a step back. You have to be able to like take a step back until it becomes just like reaction. Like, but it could probably be a detriment, like everything in life, you know, like what happens when you start just laughing at, that's why I'm kind of like scared to go to funerals and stuff personally, is because I'm afraid I've been trying to condition my brain to laugh at when things are sad, that like I'm scared to go to a funeral or anything because I don't know how I'm gonna necessarily my reaction's gonna be, you know, like I'm sad, I'm mourning, I'm grieving, but I'm also like I don't want to stay in this negative headspace, you know. And I guess it's not negative if someone passes away necessarily, but like I don't know,
it's weird. I mean, I actually had an experience within the last year where I went to, I mean, Jana's grandma's funeral, basically. And, you know, I'm a pretty stoic person. Like, I don't show a lot of emotion in some ways. In other ways, I do. But, you know, like, when I was in that room with everyone that was grieving, like I didn't know how I would react, but you know, I ended up like crying myself and like, I couldn't hold it back. Like just kind of sharing in that grief.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there was something like liberating and almost beautiful about it.
Yeah.
But it can't be put into words. Like I can't tell you what beautiful, mm-hmm. like no words wouldn't make sense. Like just the, I don't know, the scarcity of life and the fact that like this life is over and that people loved them and that, well, those are all terrible things. Like there's nothing beautiful about that. But at the same time, there is just like this beauty to the permanence and this beauty that you get to have this like deep experience. And like, I was just humbled. Like I'm having this deep experience with all of these people and there's something like honorable about that, to go through that. And I don't know, like afterwards, I was just like full of joy. And
maybe more people should go to funerals nowadays to get that perspective.
Yeah, I mean, or go to a funeral, yeah, like that, where like intimate, where, mm-hmm. yeah, it's just intimate and real because we're surrounded by all of this tragedy, but we don't, it's always separate from us in a certain way where like, it doesn't pierce through, it like just hardens us.
Yeah.
But something like that, it just pierces through. Like you can't hold back the tears. You have to like kind of just open that up and
yeah,
you know, everyone, you know, whether it's going to a funeral or just you know, taking a heroic dose, like whatever gets you weeping.
Yeah.
Like that's a good experience. You should have that like at least once a year.
Yeah.
Keep yourself humble. Like you don't want to start thinking that you're the man. You're the man stand walking around. You don't need to. I don't need to cry this year.
Yeah.
I'll cry next year.
Yeah.
No, you should cry this year. Maybe this month.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so we were, I have a bunch of notes.
You have what?
A bunch of notes here about the main topic.
Yeah.
If you want to.
Yeah.
If you want to get into it. I mean, I've just had this interest for a while and took some notes recently on the history of technology, the deep history, like starting from the Stone Age, basically, or even before that. But, I mean, this goes back to energy. So we were talking about energy earlier and how ancient people seem to be able to harness energy in ways that we've forgotten and in different ways and ways. And the entire history of technology and all that technology is energy and the ability to harness energy and leverage it, really.
Yeah.
Cause that's what humans do. But
yeah.
Starting at the absolute very beginning of life in general, like which, you know, maybe there's different theories of life that people entertain, but if you entertain the idea of basic evolutionary theory, which is natural selection, you know, passing genes on to the next generation, what else fits in there? Mutation, that nature does all these experiments. And of course that it's a competition.
Yeah.
Okay. So you've got, you know, when life starts getting complex at some point in Earth's history, it's pretty distributed. Maybe it's just multicellular life, but already you have slightly different formations of the multicellular life forms that are in slightly different environment. Maybe one's in a toxic sludge pool and the other one's in deep in the ocean by some vent next to you, know, just like these extreme environments where life starts, like, and, you know, so you've got slightly different species, slightly different environment. And then the species just kind of like adapts to the environment in such a way to where if you're next to the vent, you know, maybe you find a way to latch onto it to where it's hot, but not too hot.
Yeah. Or you like develop something that helps with shielding from the heat or something like like millions of years or thousands of years.
Yeah. Hundreds, thousands, millions of years. This happens. And, you know, all these experiments are happening. Most of the species that ever existed have died.
Yeah.
And the ones that lasted, and this is another theme that goes across the entire history of technology. The ones that last are the ones that have an unfair advantage.
Oh.
Or they have an edge, at least in their environment, or at least in evolutionary theory, they call it a niche. In some niche, they've like owned that or come up with some advantage.
Yeah.
And so and usually that advantage involves energy, like whether the energy comes from, I don't know, I'm a hyena and I've got a fucking just powerful jaw and I can chew through bones.
Yeah.
You know, like that's some kind of energy.
Yeah.
And they had an environment where it made sense to adapt in such a way. And it turned out it was a good bet to put all your energy in your jaw.
Yeah.
If you lived in the savannas of Africa or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that became the unfair advantage kind of for their little niche. And they've made it. And so, it's energy there. And, you know, you can see these dynamics all across nature. Like, the advantage you have might be a defense, might be a defensive advantage, an advantage of running away or just flying away. like a bird.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so let's talk about humans in this.
Yep.
What is humans' advantage?
With technology, or just in general?
What's our advantage above, like, in our niche, in our environment, which is whole Earth?
I mean, I don't really know. I mean, we have multiple. I would like to think.
Yeah, we do have multiple. That's true. But really, the theme is, I mean, technology, or how I'd put it, is just the ability to harness energy.
Yeah,
like we can harness energy in ways that other animals can't.
Yeah, and all kinds: dead animals for our cars, water, electricity.
We used to have to hunt whales for oil.
Dang.
But yeah, and you, humans, just like from a standpoint of like how our actual anatomy is, like. The bet, the investment for humans was our thinking capacity or our ability to communicate or abstract ideas and things, because that's what allowed us to be clever enough to harness energy in the ways that we did. Mm-hmm. Let me start to pull up my notes here. But one thing, if you think about, I love this quote from Steve Jobs. Probably a lot of people have heard this. He was just talking about like how kind of like the early Apple computers and what the computer meant for people into the future.
Mm-hmm.
And he said he remembers seeing like some nature magazine when he was a kid that was showing all the fastest animals like ranked from like number one to number 200 or something.
Yep.
And at the top was, I don't know, maybe the cheetah, something like that. And humans were like way down the list, way, way down the list, you know, like 150 or something.
Yeah.
But a human on a bicycle is at the top of the list.
Nice.
Yeah.
Hell yeah.
And so he saw computers. He said the computers are the bicycle mind.
Oh, that makes sense.
And I think what the general thing that he's kind of pointing at there is that we've harnessed energy in some kind of clever way that gives us an unfair advantage above everything. And like, because we can think and come up with these things, we can go from number 150 to jumping the whole list.
Yeah.
And that's the idea, is that it's capture or use of energy and then deploying it with leverage or levering it. Like with a bicycle, you're leveraged. You know, like how, you know, how basic level pulley, you can go across multiple, what are the actual pieces called? I think pulleys, like the circular,
a lever system or something.
Well, I guess, yeah. Lever system is the most, if you have like, you know, a board and it's on a wedge.
Yeah.
And the longer it is, the heavier the thing you can.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's the basic principle. And so something like a bicycle is like a leverage of like going from we could lift a stone to now we can lift a building or something like that. Like it was such a huge jump.
Mm-hmm.
And that's these themes that happen really across the history of technology, is these jumps in orders of magnitude where we can capture better, faster, stronger.
Yeah.
More efficiently. And that's really like where the whole story begins.
And it's not really far. I guess sound technology wouldn't really be far from that concept either. Cause I mean, I feel like if anything produces energy, humans can probably harness it to and manipulate it to do things that we want it to do.
Yeah.
That's really interesting.
Yeah. And so What came first? I think the first tool, the first piece of technology that wasn't given to us by nature, and by that I mean it wasn't like a natural sense that came with your body, or so something that was
coded, tool made by man.
Yeah, or made by anything. You know, actually, I was jumping ahead. Actually, some other animals use shells. You know, take shells from their environment, make nests. Yeah. So I guess those kinds of behaviors are worth, and that's a way of kind of using a tool or using a technology.
Yeah.
But humans are the first one to really apply it for force, it seems. Sorry, not humans. Early humanoid,
whatever,
you know, yeah, primate-esque ancestors.
Yeah.
With tools. Like the I imagine that the tool was probably just the rock.
A hammer. Yeah, like a hammer.
Or a hammer, or a bone, like in 2001 Space Odyssey.
Yeah.
He finds the bone. That's like the first moment. That's like the first, which that's why that moment, in that, I think that's why it's in the movies, because it was showing like, this is the first time that man, or not man, but like early animal, you know, used something cleverly in the environment to create force, to create advantage, create technology, mm-hmm, and used it. And then from there, the whole story changed. And then we get to Hal, you know, the AI.
Yeah.
From there. And so, yeah, that first tool, I think, was just like the rock that the, you know, one monkey used to bash in another monkey.
Yeah.
Basically. And from there, the most notable next one, I think, and one that's interesting and holds a lot of spiritual, I don't know, value and energy, it's fire.
Oh, yeah. True.
Like, fire is a natural energy that we harnessed. And you think about, like, before fire, what was life like?
Yeah, for real. Recently when I've been going camping, I just stare at fire. And I'm like, what the fuck is this? What the fuck is this? Why am I 26 and I'm in the middle of nowhere and it's 2020, there's a pandemic and I'm just staring at a campfire. I'm like, you survive off of oxygen and we breathe oxygen and you're just burning dead trees that are cut up. Like, you're just existing on these, like, you're engulfing these logs with your existence on, and you're conducting energy like that keeps me warm. Like, it's when you really break it down that way, it's like, I don't know, it's kind of a mind fuck.
Yeah. And I think like fire represents, it's like this opposite of us. We almost see it that way. Mm-hmm. Like, and you can think of like the archetype, or like yin yang, for example. Mm-hmm. Like order versus disorder, order versus chaos. And fire almost represents chaos, or these other natural forces, energy represents chaos.
Yep.
And humans have the ability to take chaos and make order from it. Mm-hmm. To take the energy that's wild and untamed and tame it and leverage it into one certain direction. You know, if you're early man, it was yeah, I mean, making campfire for one.
Yeah.
And yeah, you know, you're talking about like looking the fire. Like, I've noticed this a lot more as an adult, that like when you're cooking around the fire, just sitting around the fire, you just look into it and there's something deep in our DNA that recognizes this as a portal into something, like a portal into our, like, a place of safety.
Yeah.
A place of, I don't know, there's just something, it feels warmth. Almost holy about it.
It's warmth.
Yeah, and it just brings you into the present. It quiets your mind, relaxes you. And at the same time, I think it also connects, also opens you up for connection with those around with you. Maybe I'm getting a little woo-woo there.
No, I mean, it makes sense, but because anytime any spiritual people like express how they felt a presence of God or whatever it is, like, the term warmth is used a lot, you know, to like express enjoyment, pleasure, I don't know, safety, comfort, like without fire even being present, warmth is used as an expression to like say like you're feeling as like a way of being cared for almost or something.
Yeah.
And like yeah. And fire cannot even be present in that moment. But people are still using terms to like describe what fire is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, so fire has, it has this deep tie with us. Another thing that's unique, and this is another archetype, the idea of stealing fire from the gods, or taking the apple of Eden.
Mm-hmm.
No other animals play with fire. We're the first animal on Earth to play with fire. And, you know, like, yeah, I think that's, you can see that kind of theme in deep archetypes, types of humanity and religions, stuff like that. But we are the first, only one to play with fire. And fire, I think, was the real gateway for us into, that launched us into being capable of creating all these other techniques. And there's a few reasons why. For one, fire allows you to cook. And cooking your food is basically pre-digesting your food.
Yeah.
And so you're allocating your energy more efficiently. So you're pre-digesting your food. So then you eat that food. It takes less energy to digest, gives you more energy in turn. And yeah, so now you can cook and pre-digest your food, more energy, it's leverage right there. So you're doing the same thing, the same hunting and gathering. And on top of that, you can see at night. You could do stuff at night. You know, you can carry around a torch. You can go into caves to protect yourself. So that's like a type of defensive leverage. You can hide yourself from the element, hide yourself from dangerous animals, retreat deep into these caves and make these fires. And at the same time, while we're doing this at night, we're communicating. And I would imagine we don't know who invented fire, when fire was invented, or if language was around or communicating.
Yeah.
But I think it's obvious that fire had this huge role in allowing us to just spend all the evening, all the night talking, kind of sharpening our communication and making it more sophisticated.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and so it made us smarter. It made us kind of stronger because of our food. It made us
create communities, or it allowed communities to thrive more. You know, if you have fire, like you're saying, together, like being able to spend more time congregating and talking, and like not having to just like focus on not freezing to death.
Like, yeah, exactly. Like, you don't have to huddle up together at night. You can go, you can go out, explore at night. You have times to just sit around and just experiment. You know, was the sharpened spear, was it made first after the fire was invented?
Yeah, right.
You know, and I think that a lot of, like, certain types of wood, like you burn with the fire, you scorch it while you sharpen it, that. People used fire to burn down like entire forests. Also, like they caused great destruction just on purpose.
California.
Yeah, really. I mean, there was not much to damage back then, and they didn't care. But you know, they could do that to like scare away animals, like even big predatory animals. Yeah. Ooh, and another cool thing is that there's a certain type of mushroom. I think it's called a fly.
I'm looking it up.
But it's a kind that it's super flammable, and it stays. Basically, you can set it on fire, and you can carry it in a pouch in like a shell or something that can contain it, and the ember will stay alive for days.
Really?
And so people made fire portable. Yeah. And so people discovered, and you know, this is no doubt a product of experimentation. You just pick up some mushroom and you're playing with it in a cave at night and you set it on fire, you know, and it just has these embers. Wow. Okay. Well, this means I can transport fire now.
That's insane. I'm trying to find the name of that right now.
Fly Eric. I don't remember. I heard what's his name? Paul Stamets talking about it.
Okay. That's cool. I'll have to find it later.
But, let's see. Looking over my notes, I've touched literally two things. So we're still talking about fire. spiritual significance of fire, civilization. Okay, so I guess we kind of already... But spears. We're talking about sharpening spears.
Yeah.
I think spears and just missiles. People don't think of it as a missile.
Yeah.
But the invention of the missile was this spear or arrows, bow and arrows. And this allows, you know, like nature is inherently, we talked about this earlier, like nature is inherently unfair. Mm-hmm. It's trying, like its little agents are all trying to compete to get an unfair advantage so it can dominate its niche or dominate. And before, like, humans, you know, created fire, basically, just monkeys with rocks, you know, we were running and hiding and, you know, we had certain advantages, but with the environment was brutal. We were victims of our environment. Yeah, that's why the lifestyle was hunter-gatherers, these small groups moving light and fast. And these small groups couldn't really come together and know each other. Mm-hmm. And then you go post-fire, and we're making huge bonfires and having these spiritual, you know, celebrations and communities with each other and roaming the land and like becoming bigger and stronger and faster. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, this theme of finding this unfair advantage. And the missile is such an epitome of this when it comes to offensive, as well as defensive also as well. But fire isn't quite as much off. You can't attack at least a direct animal with fire. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're in a threatening environment, you burn the whole thing down.
Yeah.
You're surrounded by wolves or coyotes or something. I guess you could set the grass on fire around you and stuff like that. But the slings also fit into this idea of missiles, slings, spears.
Yeah, projectiles.
Projectiles, yeah. These things allow you to get up on the edge of a cliff and just throw spears down at your enemy or the animal you're trying to hunt.
Yeah.
And that's just not fair. Like, that's literally, that's unfair. Like, you... Or you know, even just like the human... up on you with spears, and then they all throw them at once.
Yeah.
And then one of them gets you, and so you're fucked. That's it. And, you know, like, it's the technology that allows us to do this. You know, you can't throw a rock mm-hmm. at a wild hog and hunt it that way. That's it.
Right.
But
you can tie that, you could sharpen that rock and tie it to a long stick that's also been modified, and you can therefore throw that spear at a hog and then injure it enough to kill it while it's, you know, injured.
Yeah, well, that's like struggling to get away.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this is like that next tier of kind of, mostly offensive capability. Mm-hmm. So now we develop better hunting technique. This gets us more time, more energy, just more of everything that we
good. Yeah.
So now we've got more time to kind of experiment, more time to reproduce, have a bunch of kids, and can actually sustain them because you can hunt bigger animals. You can hunt big game now.
Yep. Keep your kids warm with the skins and like feed them and
yeah, so you can move into more environments more fluidly.
Yeah.
Go farther, and you see how it just expands, like each of the, and these are just single innovations, and it just expands our capabilities all of a sudden. And then over like hundreds of years or thousands of years, like in human history, these technologies will come out and they'll just, we'll slowly integrate them, basically. Like, it'll slowly be adopted. Just like how the internet was slowly adopted, now it dominates kind of the world. It's the same process, this, we call it an adoption curve. It happens. And so, yeah, it's really, it really sticks with these same themes of energy and leverage. I'm trying to think if we missed anything really important in that era of like fire, got spears. So this is basically the Stone Age.
Yeah. I mean, there's like probably traps. Well, maybe not traps in the Stone Age. But yeah, I mean, it would probably...
Oh, just... I mean, I'd say traps falls into that because...
Well, I don't know. It might be a little more after the Stone Age, you know? Like, maybe. Because I feel like... I mean, we're no experts, honestly, but like... I don't know. It would make more sense to me if traps were a little later, but they could have been. I mean, it seems like in Stone Age, when I think of Stone Age, I'm thinking kind of what you were saying. Like, people were just like, oh, I found a rock. And that person has a better rock than I do. So, I'm going to try and hit them with this. It feels pretty heavy. And then just like, that's what I imagine. They weren't thinking like, oh, this thing moves faster than me, and I know where it's going. I know the trail that it's on, and I recognize it has a daily path, unlike me, a human. Like, I don't really necessarily do what this animal is doing. I can see that it's going to get water from there, and it walks. It's creating this pathway naturally in the grass. I'm going to put a string, or I'm going to dig a big hole and put sticks and leaves over it, over the path, and then wait for it to fall in. I think that took like, that probably took a long time for people to go from bashing things in the head with sticks and like stones to then like, that's like an elaborate.
Well, I think at the point that you're doing sharpening of a stick, mm-hmm. and understanding to throw that stick or to sling something, I think at that point, that's the same kind of intelligence of recognizing, oh, when something falls too far, it dies. Or if it falls into a hole, it gets stuck mm-hmm. or something like that. I could dig a hole, but how would I make it fall in? I have to hide. And, you know, you can kind of see how these ideas come about. Or with traps, I was thinking specifically, if you have like a strong but flexible branch,
yeah,
you know, you're just ancient man. You just pull on it and you stretch it all the way back and you feel that it's tensed up and then you let it go and it slings.
Yeah.
Well, that's natural energy right there. That's like a type of natural force. And so you can exert the minimal amount of force and bend that branch back and tie it up and then attach it to a net. Mm-hmm. And then you now expended that force up front. And that single expenditure, you can now just walk away.
Yeah.
And you did it one time, and now it's leveraged. It's waiting for something to step on.
Yeah.
And then it'll activate. You know, if you just had the branch and you were waiting for a rabbit to come by or whatever, you were going to smack it, the branch, or I don't know. Or you had the net.
Yeah.
And you were just waiting for it to come by and you were going to pull it. You know, so this is that way where you get efficiency and you get leverage, and all you're doing is kind of just noticing the natural forces. Or with the pit, the natural forces of gravity. Gravity goes down.
Yep.
Like, if I put you down in a place you can't get out of, you're mine, and that's it.
I'm looking it up, because it's driving me crazy.
Yeah, do it.
I mean, it's kind of, it'll be vague, because, like, I don't know. Yeah, trapping, it says a lot of, like, the... trapping that, like, net trapping was in the 16th century. But...
Oh, yeah, net trapping, I guess.
It does say Neolithic hunters. So, like, 55 to 2750 BC. Use traps. Doesn't really say what kind of... Oh, net traps, yeah. So I guess, yeah, they would use net traps with, like, hoops and stuff and, like...
Oh, well, actually, fishing first nets trap, too. The first trap involves fire. The first trap is driving animals off the ledge or driving them into a certain area to trap them.
Yeah.
By using their natural fear of fire.
Burning, force down, and that's right.
Or even just like carrying torches. You think about, I don't know, if you surround a hog efficiently and you can push them up against the edge and then push them off the edge of a cliff or something like that. And that goes right back to us as humans being the only animals that will play with fire. And because we have the foolishness to play with fire, you know, we're capable of like kind of, getting the benefits of it.
Yeah. Can't scare Shrek though. They tried. They had torches and failed.
So traps, missiles, fire.
Yeah.
We're not getting very far. But something interesting. I heard this on a podcast. Looked into it. To do with slings. There was during the Second Punic War, there was this tribe called the Gallic, or the series of tribes called the Gallic tribes, that were super proficient with these slings and arrows. They had these, like, they were like 6 feet long slings. Wow. And they would have these just fist size, or probably even smaller, I imagine. I think a little bit smaller.
Ones like this? Like they would like twirl them around their head and like...
And then let go of one of the ends.
Yeah.
And then it would sling out.
Yeah.
And so these tribes, that was just like a technology that they were especially good with and fond of. And they were so good that the Romans would say that, you know, one of these tribesmen, they could kill a Roman with a helmet on.
Wow.
You know, sling a rock into his head from 50 yards away.
Wow.
Like, you imagine you're half a football field away. You just see like, like this thing sling just around.
In the distance, a little dot getting closer and closer. I mean, isn't that what they like claim David used in like the story of David and Goliath? Like that type of sling, like that makes sense.
Yeah. And David, that's the same thing. And once again, that's a story we don't normally interpret in as Christians. We interpret the story of like Dave versus Goliath, like
taking down giants in your life.
taking down giants in your life. Exactly. And that's one framing, but another kind of way to look at it is this theme of leverage that Goliath has all of this kind of given by nature. He has these muscles and he has these kind of brute force defenses and offenses from nature. Mm-hmm. And then David represents just technology and leverage.
Yeah.
Like David doesn't need to be strong. He just needs his one shot and he needs to have enough leverage to that shot. And he needs to be skilled enough to hit it. And that's what happens. He can take down Goliath. And of course, in the story, he has the help of God, but kind of just as an archetypal way of looking at it, you know, you can see it in that way. Mm-hmm. Of man, that's just a man against nature. And so the Romans said they had these letters. One was titled Death from Above on the Romans and effectiveness of close quarters weapons, swords and spears.
Wow.
And so like they were trying, you know, they were conquering all the land and conquer these tribes people.
Yeah.
Because they were using this basically Stone Age-esque technology, the sling, just with such effectiveness.
Because they could like, they could range attack the Romans that were trying to use spears, right? Like spears and swords and melee combat, and like the Romans were like buff, or not buff, but like just like they were like very like militarized and didn't really take into account that people could hit you from afar, you know, Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, and so the Gallic tribes, their advantage was just a little bit more distant.
Yeah.
Because maybe the Romans had spears and had arrows.
But they didn't have speed and, like, mobility, probably. They had to, move as units to conquer. And sometimes that's not easy to do whenever you're facing people that are, like you're describing, that tribe is being, like, elusive and creative and smart, basically.
Yeah, and they were the defenders also, which is an advantage, which this goes right back to forces of where if you have gravity on your side, like that's just a natural defense that everyone intuits is having the high ground.
Yeah.
You know, if you have the high ground, the people that don't have the high ground, they have to fight nature as well as fight you.
Yeah.
And so you're just applying force that you didn't even create against, you know, against your enemy or against a specific problem.
Yeah.
There's a lot of stuff about missiles. Another thing is water, actually. We could just talk about all forces, nature, forces of energy.
Yeah.
But water is one that also early. But water is mostly defensive. Mm-hmm. I would say, because you can harness energy. You can farm fish, I guess. Once you learn, like if you learn how to make a dam, and you can subvert, or you can create like a divot in a stream, and you can like have fish going down there, and then you can cut it off and trap it.
Yeah.
On.
Yeah.
Something like that. Like,
yeah, it's a very passive way. Yeah. Water is a very passive form of energy, but it's essential, I think, obviously.
Yeah. And you know, early settlements, if you have any kind of settlement, you have to have a source of water.
Yeah.
Water is life for us. Like we have to have it. And so eventually, like, we develop better ways of, it's hard to carry water. Water is just heavy. I mean, you could have animals do it. We use animals as leverage to carry our load, carry our water.
That's true. Yeah, I guess animals could have been the first tool. Maybe not first, but, like, for food, you know? I guess food's different than a tool, but.
Yeah.
Definitely use oxen for like plowing and
doing anything other than just like eating,
yeah,
you know, the corpse and then having your all the fill that you can. Like that's completely primitive. But once you are like, hey, maybe we should take this, or maybe we should just skin, or maybe we should do this, or maybe we should leave it alive and actually capture it and
put all of our grain and all of our rocks on it, and then we don't have to carry it.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm basing this off of, I'm not at all an expert in anything.
Of course.
But, you know, like it really makes sense. A lot of this abstraction was developed because of fire and with our ability to like communicate and experiment in caves or in camps at night, mm-hmm. and just having the extra time and just looking around and seeing what's really around and can do with it. And talking about God-given tools, I mean, our hands, these general purpose tools that nature gave us. That's like, they're not quite for smashing. They're not quite for, like, I don't know, like you can swing with them, but you can't swing not with our weight, our bodies.
Yeah, you have to condition other limbs of your body to swing properly. Like you got to not only condition the hands, but then you got to condition what's connected to the hands and everything else, you know, to support your weight of swinging.
Yeah, exactly. It's like a different distribution using energy and using leverage, mm-hmm. and align with your environment in the trees versus, you know, at some point, primates were in the trees and then kind of went more on land. And, you know, and then our hands aren't even used for running. They don't make us faster.
Yeah.
So you almost wonder if it's like an accident. You know, we were after the Ice Age, or I don't remember, just some period in history, early man, because this is where the stoned ape hypothesis comes from. Also, is that like early man was kind of driven from the trees and barren lands and was doing tracking and finding animal school on the plains and stuff like that. But yeah, so these early humanoids end up, and we've kind of got these things. We used to use them for swinging.
Yeah.
They're made for like basically swinging and running on all fours, running away, climbing. And now we've got these things and it's like this happy accident. Yeah. Because they're able to be kind of slightly changed into something that's these very general purpose tools that let us, yeah, sharpen the stick or make the trap or the clothes out of fur, all of these things. And so,
but then it sucks that then they can equally, hands are just used to do all the heinous, horrible things too.
Yeah.
I mean, you start thinking about it.
Yeah, I mean the same hand that makes the blanket, you know, smashes the other monkeys it's a tool used for both. And you know, that's tools. We're talking about tools, leverage, energy. When people say this about tools, that like tools can be used as weapons, or people argue like, oh, a gun is not a weapon. A gun is a tool. Mm-hmm. And like really any tool is just a thing that lets you harness more energy in a specific type of way.
Oh, okay.
If you have a wrench doesn't do very well with a nail, but if you have a certain type of bolt or whatever, that like you actually have more leverage mm-hmm. using that. But of course a wrench can also, you can just like hit someone over the head and steal their money.
Yeah.
All the same. That's another form of leverage. So, you know, like that's a tool and a weapon. Or you can just, you know, loosen up someone's car parts or something, and like,
yeah,
you know, try and create a trap where they die in your car. So, you know, any tool can be used in some sense. Mm-hmm. And this goes the idea that like, yeah, we played with fire. We are the species that decided to take on the danger and the violence and the responsibility of creating more leverage, more energy within our hand. And I think that's a real story of humanity. And I think that's one that us all the way up till today. I feel like there's no way we'll get through all this since we're still literally in the Stone Ages, basically.
Well, I mean, we can always do like a two-parter. Because, I mean, what I wanted to talk about technology is like biblical technology. Maybe not biblical, but like more of like Ark of the Covenant. The chariot that, like, was it? Enoch? Was that his name? Someone was taken in a fiery chariot.
Oh.
I don't think it was Enoch. Maybe it was. The story where Elijah, where basically God was like, Elijah, you're not even going to die. I'm just going to send down a chariot and you're going to come up to heaven. Like,
yeah.
Like what? What? A fiery chariot? Like what?
Yeah, I think that was Elijah.
And at that point, is that technology? Is that a phenomena? Is that a miracle? You know, like what exactly would that be? Like a chariot is a form of technology because humans built it to leverage horses and wheels and, you know, momentum. But then like when you start talking about this thing called God sending down a fiery one from the heavens, like how are we supposed to, you know, interpret that, I guess.
Yeah. It's interesting. I have this pulled up, just like an analysis of the fire archetype. And it says here under spiritual fire, in Christianity, fire suggests religious zeal. Martyrdom is another aspect of the fire archetype. But hell also has very close associations with fire. Christians use a symbol of a candle and its flame to suggest prayer and to represent the spirit of the departed. Catholics use smoke as a part of the ritual for in selecting a new pope.
Yeah, see, I've literally always been confused why the Bible and sects of Christianity talk about fire being this, like, being all these positive things. And then they're like, yeah, but if you don't believe in it, you're going to go to a big ass place that's full of a bunch of fire forever.
Yeah. Like, I think it goes back to like the paradox of like the fire is inherently a destructive force and it's dangerous, but it's also like they're saying it's zeal, it's martyrdom, or it's like cleansing, like the cleansing fire, the spiritual fire. That it's something that, you know, like that the creation or the destruction that's inside of creation. So I think it's just like that natural coexisting of those two, you know, yin and yang.
Yeah, true.
They're right alongside each other. Yeah. And that even that Lucifer is a fallen angel.
Yeah.
That Lucifer is of the same spiritual material, but that he has so much, you know, what was it, ego?
Yeah.
Yeah, basically ego, that he wanted to be self, that he had so much power and capabilities and he wanted more.
Yeah.
And, you know, and of course these same things can be logical. It's just because it's what we know the most. But a lot of these same things, they carry across other religions all the same.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, yeah, we can. Do you want to try and do a two-parter? Do you want to get through some more of it? Or we're at an hour and 30, but I'm going to trim off like a good 15 minutes of the beginning.
Okay. No, we should just do a second-parter.
Okay.
It's fun. I feel like a lot of this, we were kind of just talking about like some of the archetypes and the early tools and kind of these foundations at which, because I use words like leverage a lot, like, ask Jana.
Yeah.
And there's just like, I have so much, there's so much behind that word for me when I think about it. And a lot of it comes back to an edge or an unfair advantage or a force multiplier. And so I think it's like, it's interesting to talk about that in a historical perspective and just analyze how big of a component or the fact that that's just the major component of what makes us who we are.
Yeah.
What brought us here. And so like that, then looking at that, get modern technology and Facebook and like all this bullshit noise that we're surrounded with all the time.
Yeah.
We're so surrounded by technology and understanding that someone else's technology or I don't know, technology that we're interacting with, it's applying some kind of force multiplier, some kind of leverage, but against what?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
and that's where it gets interesting in modern time. So
that definitely could be a good topic to start talking about for the next one. Like gradually getting to coming to that topic. I think that's a good idea.
Yeah.
Cool.
Let's do it, man.
All right. Yeah. Thanks for listening and watching, y'all.